take the scenic drive to the Guitar Oasis Cool in Jefferson County. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, jeffsguitar.com.
Welcome to another podcast at slysoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. We always like to thank our sponsors like Madison Computer Works, S&R Remodeling, AMS, and many others, including St. Vincent de Paul and the Axley Law Firm. John Nichols from the Capital Times with us. We thank him, too, for all the hard work over the years, from radio station to podcast to God knows what else. Who knows what other endeavor? Television. I think you've done some television with me at some point.
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I was certainly cheering you on when you were on John Kasich's show.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I debated the Black Avenger.
I think you did.
Ken Hamblin. Sure, you bet.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. All right. All right. So for years, Donald Trump has been tweeting about staying out of Syria. And when Barack Obama dabbled with possibly going to Syria or making some sort of military move against Bashar al-Assad, he maybe was making the point that this was the wag the dog type situation. So Donald Trump's sitting at 35% and suddenly discovered that Assad has killed women and children and babies, and boom, you got a situation where Donald Trump has now used military force in a major way. Well,
he's a liberal interventionist. Well, why did he do it, right? What was his reason?
God's children.
Right. I mean, he was deeply moved by harm coming to innocent children because Bashar al-Assad is a horrible person who apparently employed chemical weapons. And that is a humanitarian response. That's a liberal interventionist. You know, he didn't intervene, you know, for economic reasons, for, you know, strategic reasons per se, or other, you know, his heart was moved, and he's got the capacity to bomb people if his heart is moved.
Could it be this move had nothing to do with Syria, and that he was sending a message to North Korea?
No, I don't think so. I'm gonna believe.
Can you talk up just a little louder there, Jen?
Sure, totally. I'm sorry, I apologize. I'm going to believe Trump for what he says. And I always think, you know, in matters of war and peace, that's usually a good idea. Because if you try to parse it all, you know, it gets a little, you can end up all over the place. And look, the fact of the matter is that if Obama felt he could have done it, I think he would have done it. The only thing that Obama did differently than Trump was, despite the fact that Obama was profoundly moved and deeply concerned about deaths in Syria, apparently from chemical weapons, was that Obama felt that because the United States had not been attacked and because it was an intervention, an act of war, when you bomb another country like this, that he had a constitutional duty to do at least some serious consultation with Congress and, you know, under pressure from Congress, actually accepted that there was not support for an intervention. Trump does not respect the Constitution and does not understand the system of checks and balances. And so he chose to, you know, do his intervention, his act of war, without a declaration. He violated the Constitution of the United States.
Is it my understanding he did not even call the leaders in Congress?
He called some. They say he called some folks.
Okay.
I don't know when or how. They also say he called some international folks. Interestingly enough, they apparently did get a call through the Russians to tell them to move their people out of the way.
Okay. So, in other words, he just called Paul Manafort.
I don't know who he called, but
sorry.
What I do know.
Sorry, that was a cheap shot.
I think they got a hotline there, brother. I think they can get right through.
The bat phone.
Yeah. So the bottom line is some calls were made, but this is also, and I have ripped this on Democratic and Republican presidents. It doesn't matter. When they say, oh, he called congressional leaders to let them know he was going to do it. What the hell is that? That in no way gets you around the Constitution of the United States. Constitution says Congress shall declare war. It spells out, you know, things about letters of marque and all sorts of other things, right? It's a pretty clear set of responsibilities that fall on Congress, not on the President of the United States. The President does, as Commander-in-Chief, a title that's actually got meaning, as Commander-in-Chief, he has the authority to carry out a declaration of war by Congress. He also has the authority to defend the United States when it's directly attacked. These are truisms. But because your heart is moved and you decide that you're going to go and start dropping bombs on other countries, that, interestingly enough, I've read the Constitution pretty closely, and there just isn't a, yeah, I really felt like.
All right, define war.
Sure. What we're concerned about here is an act of war, okay?
Yeah.
Because you can't just narrow yourself into saying, well, this is a war and that isn't, okay? An act of war would be, you know, putting troops on the ground. But we actually have troops on the ground in Syria, over 1,000 by most accounts, perhaps quite a few more. And an act of war is bombing another country. That's an act of war. You know, and so by any measure, that is something that you need to consult Congress about. Now, again, if the United States had been attacked or was under attack and you don't have the ability to consult Congress in the moment that you have to respond in this age of, you know, intercontinental weapons and threats, President does have some authority there. But remember, Sly, that when the United States was attacked on December 7th, 1941, do you know what Franklin Roosevelt did the next day?
What's that?
Asked Congress for a declaration of war.
The good old days.
We had been attacked.
Right? No. All right.
And he said, no, but I've still got to consult. And to his credit, although I have a lot of problems with how he used the authorization, to his credit, George W. Bush went to Congress and asked for an authorization for the use of military force.
All right, let me play a bit of Donald Trump's address to the nation that was pre-recorded, and I believe they brought the engineers from the local public access channel in Palm Beach to record this.
On Tuesday, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad launched a horrible chemical weapons attack on innocent civilians. Using a deadly nerve agent, Assad choked out the lives of helpless men, women, and children. It was a slow and brutal death for so many. Even beautiful babies were cruelly murdered in this very barbaric attack. No child of God should ever suffer such horror. Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched. It is in this vital national security interest of the United States to prevent and deter the spread and use of deadly chemical weapons. There can be no dispute that Syria used banned chemical weapons, violated its obligations under the Chemical Weapons Convention, and ignored the urging of the UN Security Council.
All right. It's hard to listen to because the sound quality is A, bad. He's out of breath. And John, he sounds scared.
I don't know if it's scared or emotional. I don't know what was going on there. There was clearly, there was something going on with him that was way beyond normal. And with Trump, that's a big statement. And it's an interesting thing. John Kennedy, there's an old line about John Kennedy that whenever he would get off the plane, he always, you know, like very meticulously combed his hair. And aides would say, this was actually used in a movie some years ago. Aides would say, you know, your hair looks great. Don't worry. And he'd say, no, the president of the United States is about to get off this plane. Not John Kennedy. I got to, you know, I present myself appropriately. And similarly, Barack Obama, you know, before he would make major statements, would like calm down, center himself, make sure that he presented in a very strong, very focused way. And many presidents have throughout history. That's something I think about. Trump seemed almost as if he had run over from someplace at Mar-a-Lago.
That's right.
Yeah, to make this statement. And that's fine. I'm not going to pick on it for that. Honestly, I don't think there's any reason, you know.
Well,
but it was a very poorly produced.
Oh, it's terrible.
Thing, and it's like when the United States of America, which is the most powerful military force in the world, the wealthiest country in the world, despite my concerns about the Constitution and some other things, you know. When you're telling the world that you're going to go do this thing, you'd at least think you'd kind of produce it right.
Well, I'm going to say this, and you said you're not going to cut him apart on that. I want you to imagine if Jimmy Carter or Barack Obama or somebody had presented themselves like that, they would have gone crazy. And you know who exactly, when I say they, they would have gone insane. So I'm not cutting him
without
in
a doubt.
I'm not cutting him
cut
in a
slack. It's just that I mean, and I agree with you. I'm sympathetic. I think you're exactly right on that. It's that I think there's actually a relatively serious concern here. That's presenting the United States in a very inept, very seemingly incompetent way. And you know, the weird part about it is that we're spending so much money to fly him down to Mar-a-Lago every weekend.
$27 million so far.
Yeah, you'd think maybe they could, you know, at least get the satellite feed functioning.
All right.
Last night, by the way, that they, for a long time, they couldn't get it fed out.
All right. No, I know.
It was bizarre.
Yeah, 2017. All right, someone who, you know, has worked in television and production, and it was very, very odd. Ronald Reagan would not have done that. I'm just going to tell you that. All right, let's listen to about the consequences of this. A former CIA operative and NBC analyst, Malcolm Nance.
Well, my initial response came right after Secretary of State Tillerson made a 180-degree turn on U.S. policy. And that and the information that Vice President Mike Pence stayed in the White House tonight, those were two key intelligence indicators that the United States was going to do something significant. The level of that significance is proportionate. And a 50-60 cruise missile strike on Sherat Air Base, which, by the way, is a small secondary air base. It has never been significant except for its close air support against Aleppo, Homs, and other areas like Palmyra. But what's even more significant is that in the last few months, Sherat has been home to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And they have had forces launch attacks from there, not using aircraft, but using it as a logistics base and operations base, which is a factor that I'm sure Pentagon planners had to take into consideration. So we may not have just killed Syrians tonight, and we certainly have the capacity to strike that base. I know we struck at least, my count, 25 hardened aircraft bunkers and at least 20 weapon storage facilities. But, you know, when you hit bunkers, AAA positions, you're going to kill individuals. Also, we struck facilities that have sarin nerve gas and VX. Be prepared hard for the Syrians to claim that civilians were killed by that, by the dispersal of those weapons in the immediate area. So there are consequential actions which are going to have to take place after this, and it comes down to what will Bashar al-Assad do. Will he take this strike on the basis that the Russians believe that they'll just rebuild that base, and as Rachel said just earlier, they will take it out on the Syrian civilian population with an increased ground combat capacity, or will al-Assad feel that he needs to send a message to the United States? And we have U.S. forces within Scud missile, Scarab missile range of Syrian forces and Iranian forces in northern Syria. It could get much more complex.
I thought that was an interesting analysis.
Well, I was intrigued by it. Yeah, I thought it was very deep and very insightful. I was intrigued by one thing he said there, that very good insight. He said, boy, if they didn't destroy those chemical weapons, you can bet Assad and his people will be out saying, yeah, boy, that unleashed chemical weapons you blew over here and hit another group of our enemies.
Right.
You know, that I hadn't calculated out that level of cynicism. But, look, here's the bad deal on this whole thing. You don't want, or I should say the complexity of it all, you don't want Assad to have chemical weapons. No one in their right mind can possibly want him to have it. And the Russians were trusted to get rid of the chemical weapons and make sure they got out of there. They obviously didn't do it. And so the global community has a right to be profoundly concerned. And the thing is, though, I do wonder when, if ever, the United States will see a circumstance like this and say, it's a horrible thing. No one in the world can possibly want this. Let us exercise our moral authority and our leadership to convince the world to act, and let us act via the United Nations. Let us make the, let's find our routes to do this. And I know there are people who say, well, the Russians will block that, or somebody else will, and it'll get difficult. But, Sly, I worry a great deal about the United States being the policeman of the world and the United States being the one that responds every time. Because when you do that, you do end up in a situation where you are identified as the one dropping the bombs.
Let me just pause here. John Nichols with us at SlysOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
We're back with John Nichols, SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. All right, so let me play one more clip from Malcolm Nance for you to respond to as we talk about what happened yesterday.
Another factor to this, all that stuff is, exciting, as we say, bombs, guns, and helicopter rides, but there is a follow-on to this that we will have to manage. If Syria decides that they want to bring the confrontation to us, they have more than enough air-to-surface-to-air capacity to threaten our strategic reconnaissance assets like the Air Force reconnaissance, U.S. Navy reconnaissance aircraft that fly off of there. Our drones, they may take the opportunity to take down one of them just to show us they have the capacity, or they may ramp it up and go to Scud missiles against U.S. forces bases in northern Syria near Manbij, or, that are preparing for the offensive against Raqqa. And if they don't do it, the Iranians might do it just to show that they are independent of all of this, and that if Iranian soldiers are killed here, they may want to exact their own retaliation.
Wow. Those are all things to think about, aren't they?
I've always been rather impressed by, what all he brings to it. He's obviously a serious analyst. Look, here's the bottom line. There are tremendous dangers that extend from the steps that were taken. There might be some good that extends from it as well. If you destroy chemical weapons, I think ultimately we have to celebrate that. But the way in which it has been done, without authorization from Congress, without a clear United Nations Security Council indication or resolution, in a way that Trump himself and the people around him suggest is fluid, i.e. this may be a surgical strike, a one shot, or it might be the start of something else. With the convoluted and unclear lines of communications about this, there's a lot to worry about.
Well, John, you made a remark to me last week about how we're going to end up in Syria at war. You just kind of threw it out there, but
we were patterning in that direction, and so I hate to come back to an old friend of ours who we probably talk about too much, but this is on Paul Ryan now. The Congress of the United States is off on recess, and I know that they all like that, but shouldn't they be debating this?
Of course they should. Before we finish today, I want to ask you about Neil Gorsuch's confirmation, another chapter in the Senate for things changing permanently, probably. Do you think the filibuster, as far as legislation, is in imminent demise?
Absolutely, I do. Yeah, without a doubt. Look, Mitch McConnell has made it fully clear that if anything gets in his way, or frankly, if anything gets in the way of the Trump agenda, and remember, Mitch McConnell wants Trump to succeed not because he likes Trump, but because he sees it as necessary to maintaining his own power and his own majority. If anything gets in the way of doing what McConnell determines that he wants the Senate to do, they're going to bust the rules, period. I mean, and Sly, it didn't start on January 20th or even
first time.
January first week. Everybody keeps talking about the nuclear option. The blast took place last year when they didn't give a hearing to Merrick Garland. I mean, this is the fallout, right? I mean, don't get your crises out of order here. And there were Democratic actions before. There's been a diminution of the rules of the Senate going back, you know, you can trace some of it back 100 years. But the fact of the matter is they've gotten to a point now where I don't think that the people who are in charge think of it anymore in the ways that kids were taught in civics class, as the deliberative body, the calming body. It may be that on some issues, but the number that will matter from here on out is going to be 50. If the Republicans can get to 50, they bring Pence in and finish the job off. That's where it's at, I think. And that means that you could have major legislation passed, and we already have a cabinet with a number of members brought in, without any real deliberation, without any real consultation of the rest of the chamber. And I'll give you a story. Last night, at 12 minutes after 8, I was sitting in the TV studio about to go on Fox with Tucker Carlson to debate all this or to talk about all this. And then the news got in the way. And
then we had our lawless act of war.
So they were all talking about Syria. But, you know, I was glad. I was glad to go on Fox. I'm glad to go anywhere to talk about what I think is one of the biggest historical developments that has taken place in a very, very long time. And that is that we are restructuring the Senate. It is becoming a different chamber. In effect, it's becoming very much like a House of Representatives, only people elected at the statewide level. And if it becomes that, Sly, If that's what they choose to make it, then I think it's very appropriate to open up a debate about, you know, its purpose. Because if it's simply going to be, you know, another version of the House, elected in incredibly disproportional ways, remember where a senator from Wyoming has the same authority as a senator from California.
Right.
You know, I think we should have serious conversations about, you know, what's going on and whether we think, as we the people, think this is a good idea. Because it's, my sense is that history books will be written, and when they look back on this period, they'll talk a little bit about Gorsuch. They'll talk a little bit about this Syria thing, hopefully not too much. They'll talk about all the other stuff. But boy, anybody who's looking structurally at how the United States government operates, they're going to have to look at the change in the Senate. And we should all be talking about that a lot more. We should be paying a lot more attention to it.
Nobody really did ask the question to Mitch McConnell if Donald Trump nominates someone for the Supreme Court during his reelection campaign, if he makes it to 2020. I'm not fully sure that that's going to happen, but if that were to happen, what they would do. Is there any governing principle anymore?
No, there isn't. And Mitch McConnell's already answered that question. You didn't need to ask him, Sly. He answered it by how he handled the Garland thing. The Garland thing was not handled based on a premise or a principle. It was based on a lie. They knowingly
lied. Come on, there was the Biden rule, John. The Biden rule.
Yeah, but they had to go back, you know, deep. These are people who call themselves originalists, right? Constitutional conservatives. What did the founders intend? What were the basic premises of the thing? And to get legitimization, and I use my quote marks around that, they could only find something. The most ancient thing they could find was Joe Biden. And Joe Biden's pretty old.
Who was talking about a circumstance that was somewhat different.
So Biden was a key player in the Senate in the 1980s. We all accept that. Well, what happened in 1988? A presidential election year where a two-term president was finishing his presidency. He was done. The Congress of the United States in February of 1988 approved Anthony Kennedy for the Supreme Court. So there's no Biden rule.
Well, that's,
you know what I mean? Or if there was, it was an inconsistently applied rule.
Well, and there's a big difference between Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama.
It doesn't matter, though. I'm
being facetious. That was facetious.
Exactly. You're facetious.
All right. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
SlysOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, 5 more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.